deciding to walk away from accounting was sort of just to dip my toe in the water. And so far, I've been managing to float, which is pretty good, especially because I come from like a family that can't swim.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. In our first story, Sarath Chandra talks to two comedians about how to be funny in Australia right now.
Stand-up comedy in Australia is experiencing something like a renaissance. Even though the comedy scene isn't as big as it is in the States or the UK, it's becoming incredibly popular. For me, it's a really interesting time because there's a new and diverse breed of comedians that are coming through. Now, two of those comics are Sydney-based Lizzie Hu and Seren Jayamana. Both of them have used their backgrounds to inform their material and found the courage to get on stage. They've also figured out how to make the majority laugh, even while being in the minority.
Hi, I'm Lizzie Hu. I know, yeah, it's a cool name. People tell me, oh, you got a cool name, you got a cool name. Tell you what they don't know is my actual real name. Yeah, it's Elizabeth, Marjorie, Catherine, Gakely and who? Yeah, a little bit too long, I think. Yeah, I think my parents, they wanted me to fit in as a kid, so they gave me three really long regal names at the front to kind of hide the Asian names at the back.
Hello, my name's Seren Jayamana.
I've been doing a lot of gigs recently for very small crowds. By my choice, like I don't want your pity, right? But I read a study in the Sydney Morning Herald recently that said one in 10 Australians identify as openly racist, right? One in 10, that's crazy. When I read that, like every gig, I just call up ahead and I'm like, can we just cap the audience at 9?
I still have a day job. Grew up in Brisbane, born in Brisbane. My mum is from Toowoomba and my dad is from Malaysia. So he's Malaysian Chinese.
I'm a comedian, used to be an accountant, well, still qualified, I guess, and born in Melbourne. Now live in Sydney for the last 5 years now. Sri Lankan background. Is that relevant? When it's visual, if I don't address it, like that's people are like, why hasn't he explained this yet? When it's just audio, my voice sounds pretty. I can dial up the full ocker if you want. Don't you tell me that it wasn't meant to be. Call it quits, call it destiny. Just because it won't come easily. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
Yeah, I've been doing comedy for almost 2 years.
Been doing comedy for about 6 years. Deciding to walk away from accounting was always sort of just to dip my toe in the water kind of thing. And so far I've been managing to float, which is pretty good. Especially because I come from like a family that can't swim. So, and that applies both as a metaphor, but also we can't swim.
When did you want to become a comic and when did you first try?
So when I was young, mum, to get us to be quiet around the dinner table, she used to make us say knock, knock jokes. And I've always said from like, you know, age 4 or 5 that I wanted to be a comedian. Like, mum's like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'm like, oh, I want to be a comedian. Mum's like, that's interesting.
I reckon the first time I ever saw comedy was probably on like Hey Hey It's Saturday or something like that, which my mum used to watch religiously as a young kid. And then either that or also like the Melbourne International Comedy Festival Gala. Became more into stand-up as I went through high school, I guess. I remember like kids would be listening to music CDs and stuff, but I'd be listening to like Chris Rock or Jerry Seinfeld's albums. Or yeah, a lot of one-liner comedians like Dimitri Martin, Mitch Hedberg, that kind of thing.
Growing up, I was always like, yeah, I'm going to go to university, I'm going to get a job, and then I'm going to like rise to the top, you know? And then you kind of hit 30 and you're like, what am I doing with my life? Yeah, I need like something else interesting. And I don't know, I was going through a bit of a rough patch and I needed a creative outlet. And this is something that sort of always appealed to me. And I wanted a challenge. I wanted to be able to get up and speak in front of people. Because my whole, like, actually, the reason I did it was I was nervous speaking in front of people. And I thought, if I can do stand-up comedy, then I can speak in front of anyone. So that was that was the main motivator.
Well, look, dive in the deep end, Lizzie. Atta girl.
Yeah, exactly. I probably should have just done some Toastmasters course or something, but yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, you chose. You chose, I don't know, wisely, but you chose.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, you chose. And now you have a crippling social addiction, if you will. A need to prove yourself to random people.
Exactly. A need to be liked.
The American comedian Chris Rock once said the best way to stop gun violence in America would be to make bullets cost $10,000 each. Now, his words really stuck, because to me, the best jokes have a grain of truth to them. Now, I think sometimes comedy has the power to influence and maybe even challenge people.
Comedy provides that like nice, humorous lens into some pretty scary situations or like pretty dark places for people, and putting that funny lens on it makes it relatable for people. And I definitely think you could watch a comedian who might be talking about their experiences growing up, you know, say black in America, how that feels for them, and then people being like, oh wow, I never knew that that was what it meant for you, you know.
I think it's very dangerous when people like start to see comedy as this art form that can, like, it has a role to play, which is to poke fun at problems and like to expose, maybe to give a perspective that people wouldn't have necessarily had. But I don't think that comedy can go as far as to then like hold people to account or like change things. It can maybe just like, it goes as far as like with Trump, for example. There's no matter how much satire there is about Trump, it's not really
doing anything.
Changing anything. It might make people take a step back and be like, oh yeah, this is kind of absurd. But then even then with Trump, it's like almost gone so full tilt that now we're a bit numb to it. We're a bit like desensitized. So the more satire there is, the more we just tune out. And there's nothing, and Trump's so absurd that, like, there's so many things he does where it's like, oh, this is the last straw. But it's, how is this thing any worse than what came before? Like, if that wasn't the last straw, there'll never be a last straw, if you know what I mean. I guess, like, the first thing he said was the Mexican, like, they're coming here, they don't send their best people, they send their rapists and their whatever. That was pretty bad. And then the next thing was to grab him by the pussy thing. And then that was like, this is the last straw. And then there was he slagged off the like war, the veteran, the Muslim deceased. War veteran. Yeah. And then it's kind of like, well, they're all equally as bad as each other, but we're just slowly getting desensitized to it. And I think part of the desensitization is just the failure of comedy to actually go beyond just pointing out that he's saying crook shit. Mm. You know what I mean? So
you reckon all it does is kind of highlight stuff, helps you talk about it. Doesn't change anyone. It's generally talking to the converted anyway.
Generally. I mean, people might watch something and be like, oh, yeah, wow, that's given me a new way to think about things. But it's never going to give anyone a solution, I don't think.
Do you reckon diversity is an advantage in comedy?
There's an emphasis on trying to push diverse lineups, which I think is a good thing in general. But I do sometimes get worried with how people perceive what a diverse lineup should be and how people push that agenda sometimes. Like, I think I want my work to be respected for the work rather than people to assume that it was because of some sort of quota or whatever.
What kind of person do you want people to see when you're up on stage?
Oh, I want people to see like the real Lizzie. Like I want them to hear real stories. I mean, obviously they're sort of bended for comedy, but I want those stories to come from real places. I do talk a lot about looking Asian, but then being like quite very like Australian, or I do talk about my appearance and being half Asian. Now that I'm writing more jokes, and I'm quite conscious of the fact, I'm like, oh, I gotta write some stuff that's not about me being Asian. I can't keep saying this because it just sounds a little tired for me, but I'm like, it's not the only thing about me. Like, I am a bit more than being Asian. Yeah, like I just want to write about things that I observe, just not even referencing my cultural background or anything like that. Yeah, so yeah, it's hard though, but it is specific. Probably in the last couple of months, I've actually sat down and said, no more Asian jokes. Like, keep doing them, but like, you need to do some other stuff to balance it out.
Diversity doesn't mean, oh, we just need one of each in every story. It means we need more stories from more diverse people. So the fact that Kumail's there telling his story is pretty cool. Yeah, there might be really interesting, funny brown women, but they shouldn't come at his expense. They should just, their story should be told as well. And so in challenging stereotypes, I don't want to be, like, I never want to be considered, this guy's the spokesperson for, because I have a very different experience to so many different people from, like, a South Asian background. I grew up in a very middle-class white environment. Sure, there'll be some people who had that as well, but it's all different.
I know it's cliche, but talking with Lizzie and Siren reminded me that real life can be funnier than fiction.
Probably one of my favourite jokes that I have, just because it's like not about anything heavy and political. So I think of it as kind of like just a, hey guys, relax, I know what I'm doing kind of joke, is a joke I have about when I had to buy a vacuum cleaner. Just because the whole experience was very absurd. And I'm a sucker as well. Like, for, I don't know, I genuinely convinced myself that it was the right thing in terms of my health. And so the guy was, because of, I have eczema and I'm allergic to dust mites. So it was that was a weak admission to a vacuum cleaner salesman, because he just pounced on it. And he totally upsold me. And the whole experience was very funny. They do a little demonstration where they pour sand out and then they get the machine that you want, and it just is shit. And then they show you this, like, it's like a beast. This machine looks like a Humvee. It's like all gold, and yeah. And then they do it, and there's no way you're not buying. Once you see the demonstration, there's no way you're not buying the vacuum cleaner. And so that whole experience was just like very stressful financially, but also, oh yeah, because I guess coming out of stress is often a good inspiration to create a joke out of it. Yeah.
So I have this joke about I went to JB Hi-Fi once, and when I was leaving, the bag check guy, he was like, hey, come back. And he just said, like, do you know that eating wasabi can ward off cancer cells in your stomach? And he was actually like sucking on one of those little, you know, like little green wasabi packets. And I just looked at him like, what? What? He's like, yeah, it's really good for your stomach. And I'm like, cool. Thank you, joke gods. I'll be on my way now. So I've written a joke about it. But I kind of feel like that sort of thing happens. And I kind of think of like Mr. Squiggle. You know, Mr. Squiggle, like you get one bit of something, and then his job was to like make the complete picture. So I kind of think of like that with little situations that happen every time.
So you're the Mr. Squiggle of comedy.
Well, you heard it first.
That story was by Sarath Chandra, with help from supervising producers Alison Chan and Olivia Rosenman. I don't want to fight, I don't want to pray. Hope the bridges we burn, yeah. Light the way for another day. I only do it if I want to. Look in the mirror, do I want to? I don't know, do you know? Come on, mister. What do you feel when you look into your All the Best is a great place to learn how to produce audio documentaries. If you pitch an awesome story to us, we'll even pair you with a supervising producer to help you along the way. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. In our next story, Sheila Pham talks to Zoom Din about arriving as an international student in 1960, while the White Australia policy was still in place.
International students have become a big part of our university sector. Thousands arrive here every year to study, and a large proportion come from Asia. In 2017, the economy received $24 billion in revenue from international students. But this didn't happen overnight. So how did it all begin? We have to look deeper into the past to find out. And part of the answer lies with Australia's international aid program, which has long included university scholarships. Here is someone who came as an international student from Vietnam in 1960.
My name is Dinh Quốc Dũng. I was born in Hanoi on the 31st of May 1941.
So Zum landed one of the 15 sought-after scholarships. It gave him the opportunity to study engineering in Australia, a country he barely knew anything about.
I know nothing about Australia besides kangaroo and emu. But my thinking is everyone's sort of trying to get scholarship to go to America. I like to go somewhere different. That's why I pick on Australia. But never had any hope to get the scholarship because so many students sit for exam. So just go in and try your luck.
Zum's scholarship was part of the Colombo Plan. We'll talk later about how it was significant to Australia's multicultural history and how it helped chip away at the White Australia policy. This is what happened when Zum first arrived in Australia.
Going to Australia is, in those days, funny. The plane from Saigon to Manila, and then another plane go to Darwin. And when it come down, they said, this is Australia. I said, what? Didn't know what's going on. And then from Darwin, go to Sydney, some place in Bondi. And so everyone got out and move along just on the beach side. And it's like you are in a new planet somewhere. Didn't know what's going on.
After a few days in Sydney, Zum ended up on a plane again for his final destination.
And what was your then life like in Adelaide? Did you like it? You know, what was your impression of the city?
I found that Adelaide is, to Vietnam, it's a very quiet place, very quiet. But I can see that after a while that, and then you can study, you know, sort of with peace in mind. Another thing too, I'm curious about the Australian custom and the way they're expressing things.
When Zum was living in Adelaide, Australia was not the multicultural country it is now. So Zum was curious about the locals in Adelaide, but he was also a source of curiosity himself. One reason why Zum scored a scholarship was because of his passion for learning English. He started learning English when he met the wife of an American stationed in Saigon. This was after the French were kicked out by the Vietnamese in 1954.
One day I walk along the street near my cousin's place. I say, hello. And she said, oh, you want to learn English? I say, yes, yes. So eventually I learned English from his wife, because his wife came to Vietnam but didn't have anything to do. So that's how my English start from American. So she just taught me, and without asking anything. And my English start from there. English, when you go to high school, they teach you 1 hour, 2 hours a week. I think that the Vietnamese teacher probably wouldn't know how to speak English anyway, but just learning as if it is for the sake of learning. When I learn English, and suddenly I like English more than the French, because French is the main foreign language, because even the textbook in mathematics or science in those days is in French.
Back then, English wasn't a common language to learn in Vietnam. Zom's father was fluent in French and had studied in France. Zom, on the other hand, was part of the first generation to really learn English. Replacing French with English was part of the country's decolonization. America became involved with South Vietnam because of the Cold War, and subsequently so did Australia. One of Zom's fellow students actually returned to Vietnam after his studies in Australia to fight in the war.
Nguyễn Thế Phong. He did political science, and when he went back to Vietnam, he joined the Marine. And then he got killed. Just look back at the history of Vietnam for more than 1,000 years. And the only thing we have in history is war. War with the Chinese all the time. They always want to come down, invade the place and turn it into a Chinese region. Just like many other little countries within China now, it is like that. I can see that the peace in Vietnam is very rare, because we have to protect our own existence.
So let's go back to the Colombo Plan. The Colombo Plan was a scholarship program that began in the late 50s. It's how Zom got here, along with thousands of others from the Asia Pacific. Professor David Lowe from Deakin University explains the importance of the Colombo Plan.
The Colombo Plan forced Australians to think about building things like international student houses at universities. It forced Australians to think about what kind of standards do we expect of a host family when international students come. So the Colombo Plan helped change the mentality. It's in the cockpit of a more general phenomenon of change that is welcoming international students to Australia. And with that, of course, goes the hope that the edge would be taken off Australia's restrictive immigration policy, the so-called White Australia policy.
Colombo Plan scholars were a new way for Australia to connect with its Asia-Pacific neighbours.
We need to recall that in certain countries, such as Thailand, Laos and Vietnam, sometimes the aid programs were really the most substantial points of contact that the Australians had. They had very few relations with these decolonising countries.
The Cold War also influenced the Colombo Plan.
Clearly, Vietnam was one of those countries where, by dint of the French being kicked out of Vietnam, and by dint of the communist successes in the northern part by the late 1950s, it was clear that there was a particular interest on behalf of the Australians in the shoring up of an anti-communist South. So that's one dimension. But also the development needs of the country and the whole kind of thinking around the future of the Mekong Delta were also in the minds of Australians. But what's interesting for us, looking back on the Colombo Plan, was how Australians started responding to more Asian students studying in Australia. We need to remember that by the end of the 50s, only about 1 in every 6 Asian students in Australia is under the Colombo Plan. Most of them are private students. So the Colombo Plan, though, helps the Australian authorities set the standards. They all of these private students coming to Australia, they're sort of encouraged to have the same set of expectations that the Department of Education and the Department of External Affairs had drawn up for Colombo Plan students.
Scholarships were awarded on the basis that students return home after their studies and bring back Australian know-how with them. Going back to Vietnam was more complicated, however, because of the war.
The whole deal with the Colombo Plan was that you had to return home upon completion of your study. You were meant to return to your country, and you were meant to bring back to your country all those skills that you'd learned and to apply them and help your own country develop. So in order to stay, you had to mount a case was extraordinary in some way. Prosecution and circumstances of war would definitely qualify as one of those things that the Australian authorities would have looked at. Or you had to marry. That's the other way in which you could stay. If you married an Australian, then that was probably the simplest way to stay.
So let's return to Zoom. What happened to him after he graduated with his engineering degree? Well, by that stage, he'd gotten together with the Australian woman who became his first wife.
So we decided to stay. But in that time, I said, okay, because I learned all the theory, but I know nothing about the practical side of the thing I do, mechanical engineering. One of the company I work longer time is Chrysler Australia Limited. And I want to learn as much as I can as a plant engineer. And plant engineer is the one that looking after all the production facilities. And to do like that, when we go back to Vietnam, I can be useful then.
But Zum always had it in mind that he'd make it back to Vietnam one day.
I couldn't achieve it to go back to Vietnam until 1996. And I went back to Vietnam to work as the manager for a British consulting firm in Vietnam. That is when I give them as much of my experience as I can. Even sometimes tell them a bit about, you know, how to express in English and everything else. I want to give everything of mine to the Vietnamese because I feel that I have to repay the country as much as I can because Australia is my country, but Vietnam is the place I was born. Australia is very precious to me because Australia has educated me to be what I am now.
That story was by Sheila Pham, with help from supervising producers Zasha Rosen and Alison Chan. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and future. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Community Coordinator. Matilda Fay is our Social Media Producer. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and find all our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe to us on your podcast app.